on The Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, February is American History Month and Black History Month. We've got a wonderful juxtaposition of the two today at our special guest, Dan Hallman, who is the Air Force Historical Research Office at Maxwell Air Force Base, and he also earned his PhD in history from Auburn University in 83, has authored 9 books about Air Force history, 28 articles published in various journals and magazines, the co-author of The Tuskegee Airmen and Illustrated History, 1939 to 1949, and his newest, which is The Tuskegee Airmen Chronology, a detailed timeline of the Red Tails and other black pilots of World War II. It's from New South Books out of Montgomery. And Dan, thank you so much for taking time today to talk to us on The Bookshelf.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad to be here.
One of the things that I liked about your book is that it has lots of information about the era of the Tuskegee Airmen that is probably better known now than at any point in history, maybe more widely known. But you also give a considerable amount of history in your chronology of the black pilots, both men and women, who preceded the Tuskegee Airmen and were pioneers for the airmen.
That's right.
How did you get interested in, and of course this is your second book about the airmen, how did you get interested in their particular circumstances and their particular contribution to American military history?
That's a good question. I've worked here at the Air Force Historical Research Agency for more than 35 years, and it wasn't until 2006 I started focusing on the Tuskegee Airmen as a subject. And the reason I did was because at the time I was researching aerial victory credits, those Air Force pilots who shot down enemy aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote an article that year about the aerial victory credits of the Tuskegee Airmen. They shot down 112 enemy aircraft during World War II. And the article I wrote that year in 2006 was focusing on their aerial victories. And it just kind of grew from there in the course of my research into their narrative mission reports and their monthly histories in World War II. I discovered a lot of other things about them. And as we got increasing questions about the 332nd Fighter Group and other Tuskegee Airmen units, I was the one people would start sending requests to.
Because of the movie Red Tails, because of your previous book, and because of the so many interviews and articles about the members of the Tuskegee Airmen that have been coming out in recent years, I would think largely as a result not only of more interest in hearing about them, but also because they're getting older, and we're losing them just like we are all of our World War II vets.
Right.
People who know much about the Tuskegee Airmen probably know about the airmen flying in the Mediterranean theater, but those were not the only kind of missions that they flew. And I did, and I must admit to you that until I read your book, I did not realize that the Tuskegee Airmen also included men who flew bombers and who flew bombing missions. And And I never thought about this, but of course, the support personnel had to be trained as well. So,
The bombing group, the 477th Bombardment Group and its four squadrons, were formed during World War II, but they never did deploy overseas. They never entered combat. But it's an important part of the Tuskegee Airmen story because while they were training, there were important events, such as, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Freeman Field Mutiny.
Yes.
Which involved the desegregation question at Freeman Field. And that was an important chapter in civil rights history a lot of people don't realize.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Nowadays, we don't really think about what it must have been like for a bunch of black men to come to a particular part of Alabama and be treated evenly or equally. We knew it was back during the Jim Crow era, and slowly enough, these stories don't really surprise us all that much. But the members of the airmen and the support personnel, the officers, didn't just take the insults lying down.
Well, at Tuskegee, there was an open-minded, fair commander at Tuskegee Army Airfield named Colonel Noel Parrish. And even though he was a white Southerner, he was willing to desegregate the facilities at Tuskegee Army Airfield, and that happened peacefully. But it was the 477th Bombardment Group's experience at Freeman Field, Indiana, where there was more trouble, because the commander, the white commander of the 477th Bombardment Group, who was in charge of helping train the bombardment group and the bombardment crews, wanted to establish separate facilities at Freeman Field. So he had a black officers club and a white officers club, black recreational facilities, white recreational facilities. And that caused a lot of friction. And about a fourth of the black officers that were at Freeman Field, they had about 400 black officers at Freeman Field at the time, but about 120 of them resisted the segregation policy, and they were arrested. I don't want to go into detail about, there were two rounds of arrests, but a total of 120 black officers were arrested. And it really affected the country, because there was a lot of publicity about the controversy. Ultimately, the War Department decided to reassign all the white officers of the 477th to other units, and the 477th Bombardment Group, like the 332nd Fighter Group that had been overseas, became an all-black organization. But it highlighted the segregation efforts of the desegregation efforts of the Tuskegee Airmen.
Were the Tuskegee Airmen initially, were they given adequate places to stay, adequate airplanes to fly? I mean, you read about accounts from the Civil War where black Union soldiers were given substandard weapons or no weapons at all to train with, and or substandard uniforms and boots and so forth. Did that sort of situation occur when the first flyers came to Tuskegee?
Well, that's somewhat exaggerated. I think part of that is rooted in the fact that some of the primary flight training aircraft were biplanes. But that wasn't just for the Tuskegee Airmen. That was for the other pilots in primary flight training.
Okay.
Black and white were in primary flight trainers like PT-17s, PT-13s, PT-19s. And because they were flying in these old-fashioned type airplanes in the first stage of flight training, sometimes people get the impression that they were given these World War I airplanes, and that's not really factual. After the primary flight training, they, like other white, like white pilots, moved to the basic training aircraft, BT-13s, and then to the advanced trainer, the AT-6s, and then to the types of aircraft they'd be flying in combat. They first flew in combat in P-40s, which were the same kinds of aircraft the Flying Tigers flew in Asia. And sometimes you hear stories about the P-40s were inferior aircraft. Well, you have to look in context. There were a lot of P-40 units in North Africa and Sicily and Italy. At the same time the Tuskegee Airmen were flying them, there were white pilots also flying P-40s. But there's some truth to it, because the P-40 wasn't an aircraft that was used at the time for aerial combat, because it had become somewhat obsolete, not only for the Tuskegee Airmen, but also for the white pilots. So they used them for the 12th Air Force to support forces on the ground, to destroy targets on the ground, and not for aerial combat. When the Tuskegee Airmen got the mission of escorting bombers deep into enemy territory, including over Germany, then they were assigned better aircraft that were faster and that had a longer range. And it's with those kinds of aircraft, like the Redtail P-51s, that they achieved more of their reputation.
Well, that makes sense, though. That's more mission sensitive, to provide them with an airplane that would be better for the task that they were given to take care of.
Right. Now, there's some truth to that about the hand-me-down planes, because when the Tuskegee Airmen were flying for the 15th Air Force, for example, at first they were flying bomber escort missions in P-47 aircraft, and the other groups were flying P-51s or P-38s, which were really had longer range and were somewhat faster. But the 332nd Fighter Group inherited the P-51s of the 325th Fighter Group when the 325th Fighter Group started acquiring newer models that had the bubble canopy. So there's some truth to that. They did get some hand-me-down planes from another group in the 15th Air Force, but soon they acquired their own bubble canopy P-51s. And so eventually they were all flying the same kind of aircraft.
We're talking, if you're joining us, to Dr. Dan Hallman, who is the Chief Organizational History Division at the U.S. Air Force Historical Research Agency. He has authored many books and scholarly articles about the Tuskegee Airmen, including as co-author of the best-selling work, The Tuskegee Airmen and Illustrated History, 1939-1949, published by New South Books. His newest book, The Tuskegee Airmen Chronology, a detailed timeline of the Red Tails and other black pilots of World War II, which is also from New South Books. As a member of the Tuskegee Airmen Incorporated for many years, Dan has attended 8 of the organization's conventions and counts many Tuskegee Airmen as personal friends. So we're particularly pleased to have him here with us today for American History Month and Black History Month on the bookshelf. Do you want to start back and tell us a little bit about some of the pioneers that preceded? We have flyers as far back as World War I before the United States was officially in the war.
Yeah, to give you some background, the airplane was invented in 1903, and the Army received its first airplanes and had its first pilots in 1909. But there were no black pilots in the American military until 1942, and they were Tuskegee Airmen. During that more than 30 years, there were black pilots, but they were civilian pilots, and some of them became somewhat famous, especially in the black community in the early 20th century. And I might mention one of them. There was an African-American pilot who flew in combat in World War I, but he was not allowed to serve in the American Air Service. He served in the French Air Service.
Right.
Even though he was from the United States, and even though he was an American, he was, I think, originally from Columbus, Georgia. But he flew for France, and when he, like many other American volunteers in France, tried to join the American Air Service, which went to France in 1917, he was not allowed to join them because he was black.
And was that Corporal Eugene Bullard?
Eugene Bullard, that's right.
Between the wars, there are incremental steps. Bessie Coleman becoming the first civilian licensed African-American pilot in the world, receiving her license in France.
Right.
And more and more black pilots who come as private students and not in the military.
That's right.
But gaining experience and showing, once again, that black people can fly airplanes.
That's right.
It seems such a silly concept to us now in the year 2018. That was a big sticking point back in those days.
Yeah, so there was a civilian pilot training program that President Roosevelt authorized in the late 1930s. And there were several black universities or colleges that were selected for sites where black civilian pilots would train, and there was one at Tuskegee, and there was a man named Chief Charles Alfred Anderson, called Chief Anderson. He wasn't really a chief master sergeant or anything. They just called him Chief because he was the chief civilian pilot at Tuskegee, and that's one reason, because of the civilian pilot school there, that's one reason Tuskegee was chosen to be the place where the military flight training would take place, starting in 1941.
Okay, that makes sense. They already had some of the facilities and a tradition of training pilots there.
They had a tradition of training pilots, but the facilities for the military flight training had to be constructed. For example, if you go to Tuskegee today, the Tuskegee Airport is Moton Field, and that's where the primary flight training took place for the military pilots, the first stage of flight training. And that had to be constructed, because where the civilian pilot training school was a different field in a different part of Tuskegee, which was a little south of Tuskegee. Moton Field is a little northwest of Tuskegee.
Now, according to your book, there were also black pilots that did some training in Auburn as well, at the airfield there.
Yes, before the airfield at Moton Field was finished. I said northwest of Tuskegee. It's a little northeast of Tuskegee. But before that was completed, some of the black pilots in early flight training did go to Auburn and train there. There is a connection, if you're interested, in between Troy and the Tuskegee Airmen.
Oh, absolutely. Tell us.
There was the primary flight training at Moton Field, but the basic and advanced flight training and more advanced types of aircraft took place at a much larger airfield northwest of Tuskegee called Tuskegee Army Airfield. That was the more important base. It was a very large base. It had paved runways. It had three large double hangars. And it, when it finally closed after World War II in 1946, those three large double hangars were disassembled and moved to civilian airports where they could be useful in sheltering aircraft. And those three double hangars that were at Tuskegee Army Airfield are now still in existence, still being used, one of them at Montgomery's Danley Field at the Montgomery Regional Airport, one of them at the Clanton Airport, and one of them at the Troy Airport.
Well, how about that? That is very cool. And you know, in Troy, there's a private collector who has one of the largest, if not the largest, collection of privately owned flying World War II airplanes in the world.
I didn't know that.
The training that these men receive, Tuskegee, and nonetheless, they're receiving excellent training, but nonetheless, they're still segregated. They're still off to themselves and bridged from doing a lot of modernizing with, say, in Montgomery, which is not that far from Tuskegee.
That's right. Tuskegee was somewhat isolated. There was a segregated mandate for the training. The black units, the black pilots would be assigned to black units. They would start out with white commanders and eventually receive black commanders. But the racist philosophy within the War Department at the time is they didn't want a black officer in charge of any white soldiers or white airmen.
Right.
And so they had segregated units. And the Tuskegee was one of those places that had white personnel, white flight instructors. At first, all the flight instructors at Tuskegee Army Airfield were white. But, of course, the cadets were black. And eventually, more and more of the flight instructors at Tuskegee Army Airfield became black, especially after some of them had combat experience overseas and came back to Tuskegee Army Airfield to teach.
Now, here's something that I had never heard before, and it might be because I've never lived in Auburn, but here's a notation in late spring 1943 that the white mayor of Tuskegee, Frank Carr, offered the use of the city swimming pool to military personnel residing in Tuskegee. Presumably all these personnel were white since the black personnel were residing at Moton Field, Tuskegee Army Airfield, or the campus of Tuskegee Institute.
That's right. Most of the black personnel at Tuskegee Army Airfield stayed right there on the field. But the white personnel, and there were many of them, because there were a lot of flight instructors and the commanders of the base were white, but they didn't live at Moton Field. They lived either in Tuskegee, the white part of Tuskegee, or at Auburn. Many of them lived at Auburn and commuted.
Yeah, it's not really that far. It's just right down the road. Even before the highways were built, it wasn't really that far.
Right. If you look at the markers on I-85, exit 38 is where Moton Field is, Tuskegee Army Airfield. I'm sorry, Tuskegee Airmen National Historic Site today. And exit 51 is Auburn.
Now, a little bit later that same year, September of 43, when the War Department announces the training of black pilots for bombers, the type of bombers that these guys train, the twin-engine A-10s, how big a crew did they have? Because the Tuskegee Airmen didn't just consist of pilots, certainly bombardiers and navigators and so forth.
That's a good question. The A-10 was just to train the pilots and co-pilots.
Okay.
But that wasn't the final product. The final airplane that the bomber pilots would fly was the B-25.
Okay.
The B-25 was a twin-engine bomber that was the same kind of bomber that the Doolittle Raiders used in April of 1942 when they bombed Japan.
Okay.
And the B-25 was used all over the world in, by different numbered air forces. And that's the type of plane the Tuskegee Airmen flew. It had a crew of six, which included the pilot, the co-pilot, a bombardier, a navigator, radio operator, and gunners.
Now, did those guys train at Tuskegee, or was Tuskegee strictly for pilots?
It was for pilots. The bombardiers and navigators and radio operators trained at other bases. So the Tuskegee experience is called Tuskegee Airmen, and it focuses on Tuskegee for the pilot training, but there were many other bases involved around the country that trained some of the crews that later served in the 477th Bombardment Group.
And certainly the support personnel, the people on the ground, the guys that fueled up the plane, and the engineers that kept
things together. Many of them trained at Tuskegee if they were associated with the fighter pilots. The bomber crews mostly trained, except for the pilots and co-pilots, at other bases.
That makes sense, though. I mean, that's kind of the way, isn't it? You specialize and you put people together based on their specialty. You wouldn't have that'd be like having the artillery and the air cavalry and the infantry all training in the same block or so.
That's one of the reasons why the 477th Bombardment Group never deployed overseas. It took longer to train all those different specialties that would serve together as a crew in a B-25. And it also started later than the fighter group. The first fighter, black fighter squadron started in 1941. The first black fighter group started not long after that. But the first black bombardment group, the 477th, started at the beginning of 1944. So that's one reason it never deployed overseas. By the time it was ready to go overseas, the war had just ended.
And of course, when people are being trained, we're not sure when the war is going to be over. You've got to continue to train people. You can't say, well, it looks like the Japanese are going to quit any day now. We can just shuff all the training.
Well, believe it or not, even though the training wasn't shut off, it was reduced.
Scaled back.
Once we got to a certain point in 1945 and it looked like victory was almost inevitable, we didn't know exactly when it would happen, then the training did start to taper off, though it didn't end until later. In 1946, for example, the year after the war ended, that's when Tuskegee Army Airfield shut down.
That makes sense, though, because, again, if you've got somebody halfway through their training, it does seem like the Army would want to go ahead and finish the training, even if they didn't need them for that war. You never know what's on the horizon.
Well, that's a good point, because the black flying units didn't end with the end of World War II. They continued to exist. They were stationed for a while at Lockbourne Army Air Base, which became Lockbourne Air Force Base in Ohio. And that's where the black flying units were stationed when the Air Force integrated in 1949.
Were the U.S. Air Force, when they desegregated, did that in the all-black flying units, or was there de facto kind of situation where they were still all-black units for a short time until everything kind of settled in?
Well, if you're talking about the flying units, the black flying units were all concentrated at Lockbourne. And I say the black flying units, there were a fighter squadrons, a fighter group, the 332nd, and a fighter wing, the 332nd fighter wing, that was at Lockbourne between 1947 and 1949. And when the Air Force inactivated those black flying units, then the personnel went to formerly all-white organizations. But I might mention, between 1946, when Tuskegee Army Airfield closed, and 1949, when the black flying units were inactivated and their personnel reassigned, during that three-year period, the Air Force was still training black pilots. And this surprises a lot of people. They were training most of them at Williams Field, Arizona, in a desegregated basis. So the Air Force was already moving toward integration between 1946 and 1949, when some of the black pilots were being trained at Williams Field in Arizona. And I might mention, too, that Noel Parrish, who was the white commander at Tuskegee Army Airfield, wrote a thesis after World War II. He came to Air University here in Montgomery, and he wrote a thesis advocating the integration of the Air Force.
Nice to know. It's good to know that there were those white officers that saw the value of the men and their courage, their dedication, their competence and recognized that and didn't look at the externals but looked at the man themselves.
Right. I don't want to give the impression that all the white officers were like that. They had plenty of opposition from some others. For example, there was a white officer who was commander of the 33rd Fighter Group overseas. And when the 99th Fighter Squadron went over there, black flying unit, but without a black group to be assigned to, because the 332nd was still back in the United States, the 99th was attached temporarily to the 33rd Fighter Group. And the white commander of the 33rd Fighter Group, who already had three white squadrons assigned to his group, tried to take them out of combat. And there was no real justification for that except braces.
Yeah. It's well known that the Tuskegee Airmen had an exemplary record fighting in the Mediterranean theater in World War II. We have a few minutes left. Would you like to go ahead and give credit where it's due to these
sure.
Heroes?
Let me point out there was a false claim that circulated for many years about the Tuskegee Airmen. And that false claim was that they had never lost a bomber to enemy aircraft. That was never true. But they lost fewer bombers to enemy aircraft than the other fighter escort groups in the 15th Air Force. Just to give you an example, some statistics, they flew 179 bomber escort missions for the 15th Air Force. And the Tuskegee Airmen lost bombers on only 7 of those missions. And if you count all the bombers that were shot down under Tuskegee Airmen escort, the total comes to about 27. The average number lost by the other fighter groups was 46. So they lost significantly fewer bombers than the other fighter groups. And that's probably the main reason, the main thing people point to show how well they did.
Yeah.
They also shot down 112 enemy aircraft. But if you just look at numbers of enemy aircraft shot down, they did better than two of the fighter groups in the 15th Air Force, but the other fighter groups had higher scores, the ones besides the other two.
Well, it's certainly a really important part of our history. I'm delighted that you and other people are doing so much to let everybody know about the incredible history of the Tuskegee Airmen. And with your new book, the people that preceded them and what happened after the war. It's a fascinating and wonderful chapter. And Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share what I've learned.
Absolutely. Well, I hope that we'll get a chance to talk again, because I have the feeling this is not the last book that there is to be had about the Tuskegee Airmen. You've had several, but I think there's lots of stories here.
There are, yes. Thank you.
Dr. Dan Hallman, who is the Air Force Historical Research Agency, the chief of the Organizational History Division at the U.S. Air Force Historical Research Agency, and the author of today's book, The Tuskegee Airmen Chronology, a detailed timeline of the Red Tails and other black pilots of World War II. It's from New South Books. And Dan, thank you so much for being with us today on the bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much for asking me to be on.
Our thanks once again to Dan Hallman, the author of The Tuskegee Airmen Chronology from New South Books out of Montgomery, Alabama. The website is newsouthbooks.com. You can also just go in and Google U.S. Air Force Historical Research Agency, and you can find their website, which will also take you more information about the airmen that way. newsouthbooks.com will also have the other books that Dan has written or co-written from New South Books that are available still in print. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed all month long our look at historical people, historical places, historical events during American History Month and Black History Month. And next month is Women's History Month. Got some real special books planned for us to talk to the authors thereof. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station. Also check out my website on thebookshelf.biz. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.